This is an occasion of the year when our desert island seems very far from being deserted, because I'm speaking from the National Radio Show at Earls Court, London. We're on the grandstand, surrounded by a very large crowd of people. However, this week's castaway is a man who's used to working in the middle of crowds. He's the possessor of a very familiar voice. We've heard him give many vivid and exciting commentaries from a good many parts of the world in both peace and war. It's the BBC's senior reporter, Godfrey Talbot. Now, Godfrey, in your travels, have you had any experience of solitude, not necessarily on a desert island?
No, I don't think I have, not absolutely alone. In fact, I'm sure I haven't.
Why do you think you've faced up to it?
Well, I think I spend most of my life trying to get a bit of peace and quiet, and I think I should be delighted at first. Mm. I like getting away from it all. I like to walk and be in the country alone. But whether I'd welcome absolute solitude, for a long time, is quite another matter.
Do you consider yourself a musical person?
No, I don't really. I'm probably tone deaf and tune deaf. I do like music. If there's a tune in it. I make bull-like noises, which I call singing, but from which my family run in all directions. As a matter of fact, they let out hoots of derision when they heard I was going to appear on this program. In their opinion, I'm the last man to be let loose with gramophone record.
I doesn't stand for that. You didn't have music lessons as a child?
No, yes, I did. I was in the usual Bluebells of Scotland piano learning stage, but I'd hear the sound of a cricket bat when I was practicing and I'd be off. My music taste is capricious and thorny, I think. I'm idiot simple, and I don't go beyond melody. As a child, I was cradled in nonconformity and brought up on hymn tunes, and I still think that hymn tunes are some of the best melodies in the world.
Now, how did you set about choosing these 8 records for the desert island? Are they records of personal memories, or
well,
what?
Partly. Although, either consciously or unconsciously, I'm sure I'd avoid certain music which would evoke memories that might prove, well, too poignant in exile. Music that would bring to my memory moments of great happiness that would be so much beyond recapture that the music would be unendurable.
What's the first record you've heard?
At a fairly early age, I was pitched into quite a lot of opera going, and I read the start with an excerpt from an opera from Tosca.
Yeah. How do you mean pitched into opera going?
Oh, it was during my early days in journalism. Tickets used to come my way, and it seemed a pity to waste them, and so I grew to go to and like opera. The provinces used to get a good deal of opera in those days, largely from the British National Opera Company. And one of my favorite was, and is, Tosca.
Mm-hmm. Which part of it do you choose?
Oh, right at the beginning, almost, where Angelotti has come into the church looking for a hiding place, and now you hear the sacristan come pitifying in.
Sempre là va, ogni pennello è sozzo, peggio d'un collaretto, uno scagnozzo. Signor pittore, do nessuno. Avrei giurato che fosse ritornato il cavalier Cavaradossi. No. Sbaglio, il paniere intatto.
What is the opening theme of Tosca, a Carla Milan recording sung by Melchior Luis?
What's your second choice?
A waltz to sustain me in my exile. There's always something lifting about a waltz.
And here's one of my favorite Rosenkavalier waltzes, one that I could bear to listen to any number of times. There's a lovely, smooth, full recording by the Hollywood Bowl Orchestra.
Thank you.
Olamide from Der Rosenkavalier, played by the Hollywood Bowl Orchestra conducted by Felix Flatkin. Dr. What part of the country do you come from?
The West Riding of Yorkshire.
Now, I've yet to meet the broadcaster who set out to be one of the trial. What was your first ambition?
To be a journalist.
And what was your first job?
Journalism.
Splendid.
Curious how strong that ambition was. At school, I remember at speech days, I used to watch the reporters with envy to help me, sitting in the front taking notes. And I learned shorthand in my spare time.
Well, what was your first job in journalism, sitting in front taking notes at speech days?
No. I had to begin as an editorial office boy, making the tea and learning the business from the bottom.
This was in Yorkshire.
This was, in fact, on the Yorkshire Post. And then I was promoted to be a reporter, and I did all the usual jobs, you know, reporting police courts, flower shows, church bazaars.
How long were you with that paper?
5 years, I think it was.
Now, by the end of that time, had you started to specialize at all?
Partly. Though, knowing jolly little about it at first, I became, so helped me, a dramatic critic.
Oh, yes.
I remember savagely one poor company that came to Leeds. With all the precocity of youth and inexperience, I really tore them apart. And the next day, the manager of the theatre company and the principal actors all turned up in my editor's office, demanding my head and that another affair or notice should be written. Well, my editor, great editor, Arthur Mann, said there couldn't be another notice because the paper stood by what representative had written. But by golly, when he'd visited and gone, he sent them to me, and he gave me the biggest and the most salutary wigging that I've ever had.
Well, on behalf of actors and playwrights everywhere, may I say good for him.
What was the next move? Well, I went to a weekly paper in Manchester to be modernized, and I was hired as an assistant editor.
Mm-hmm.
They thought that being a young man, I'd have some modern ideas, and then the editor retired, and I took over his chair, and I became an editor at the age of 24, much too young.
How did the paper do?
Well, we did all right, as a matter of fact, very well. But after a while, there was a financial reorganization of the group the paper belonged to, and the paper died under me.
So?
Well, I went back quite happily to being a reporter with a big Manchester Daily Paper group. I went there for a couple of years, and then I joined the BBC.
Well, now, what inspired that move?
Well, believe it or not, I wanted to get away from news.
Well, that you certainly failed to do.
But what did you join the BBC as?
A public relations officer.
A public relations being more or less a polite name for public.
Oh, more or less, right.
Well, now, having got to as far as the BBC staff, I think we'll stop for another record. What's it going to be? I mentioned earlier my love for the old evangelical hymn. Well, here's a favorite of mine, not quite a bad kind of hymn, but I've always found it very moving. It's the metrical setting of the 23rd Psalm, the Crimmins setting, beautifully sung by the Glasgow Orchestra.
Part of the Crimmins setting of the 23rd Psalm, sung by the Glasgow Orchestra.
Now, picking up on your life story, Doctor, you just joined the BBC. Carry on from there.
Well, I worked in our public relations department in Manchester, then in Birmingham, and after a couple of years, the war broke out.
Well, the authorities said that everyone who was skilled in a needed trade must go into that trade, so I was directed into the BBC's news department in London, and I became one of the sub-editors.
When did you start broadcasting yourself?
Well, soon after that, they began to try me out with an occasional talk in the news bulletin. Then, just after Dunkirk, I was accredited as a war correspondent, first of all with the Home Forces, and then just about the time of the fall of Tobruk, they sent me out to the Middle East.
Yes, and you followed the 8th Army from Alamein right up into Italy.
I did, and that, of course, was broadcasting like mad, because the Desert War was the war then, and the 8th Army was the news.
Well, one broadcast of yours from North Africa that very many people remember, with the good news from Alamein, the breakthrough.
I remember recording that dispatch because I was standing out in the desert with the tanks grinding past on both sides of me, looming up out of the fog of sand, the
that they were throwing up, and I couldn't see them until they were practically on top of me, and so I was leaping from one side to the other, still talking as I heard them coming, and I remember one of them cut the cable between me and my reporting truck. One of the other big stories to remember from the war. Oh, the entry into Benghazi, the fall of Tripoli, Churchill's visit, the Axis forces being cleared out of Africa, the Mediterranean free, and then the war in Italy, of course, the entry into Rome, the fall of Castino.
Where did you go up to when the war ended?
On VE Day, I was up near the Brenner Pond.
Very clever.
Right. Well, at this point, I think we'll stop for another record. What are we going to have now?
We've been talking about the war. There's one record that never failed to take me back, and many other people too, I think, to the Western Desert.
It was one of the enemy's songs. To begin with, it used to be put out the German forces' radio, and in the hope that our side would listen too, and it would seduce them perhaps from their duty. Well, they did listen, but what they did was capture this song from the Germans and made it the Eighth Army song. It is, of course, Lili Marlene, and this is the original German record with Laula Anderson.
Vor der Kaserne, vor dem großen Tor, stand eine Laterne und steht sie noch davor. So wollen wir uns da wiedersehen, bei der Laterne wollen wir stehen, wie einst Lili Marleen, wie einst Lili Marleen.
Lili Marlene, sung by Laula Anderson and Chap. Now, what happened to you after the war, Godfrey, when you got back from Italy?
Well, you are asking me to talk shop. I had to decide whether I wanted to stay with you in the BBC and stay in London, and I decided that I did. I went to work to found and to build up our reporting unit, and I also became the BBC correspondent accredited to Buckingham Palace.
Now, what did that involve?
Well, obviously, there's so many big royal events we must cover, and I agitated that there should be a suitable chap appointed especially for this work. The powers that be at the time thought this was a very good idea, and they got the post approved, and then they said to me, all right, you can have your chap, it's you.
Well,
I didn't give, because that coincided with an upsurge of a feeling that I always have, a dislike of sitting at a desk. I know I'm sitting at one at this moment. It meant that I could get out into the field again.
Yes. Well, it certainly meant you would get out into quite a lot of fields.
How many royal tours have you been on?
Oh, I don't know. All the lot. I've been round the world and through very many countries. 50,000 miles, one trip alone,
I think it was.
And I've been to Canada and the USA on four occasions and to many parts of Africa and, I suppose, all the whole of Europe.
Yes.
I gather that these tours are by no means a joyride for the people who are reporting them.
By no means a joyride for anybody at all. You see, the Queen and the Royal Party usually put in about a 12-hour day on these journeys. The journalists have to put in a much longer one, because they've got to be there, wherever it is, when the Royal Party arrives, and at the end of the day, they have to stay and get off their stories, get off their film or their tape.
Yes.
And as far as radio is concerned, there may be circuits from wherever it is to London at all hours of the day and night. Quite honestly, I don't know of any assignment at all in journalism that is so rugged as a major royal tour.
And, of course, you're moving on to somewhere different practice every day.
Certainly are, always on the move, and it makes it terribly difficult, incidentally, to organize yourself. Speaking personally, that shopping, for instance, each town that the Queen visits is having the one big day of its lifetime, and nobody's going to open a shop. They consider it almost high treason to do any buying or selling on that particular day.
Yeah.
So if you run out of, say, toothpaste, well, you're in real trouble. I remember once in New Zealand trying every day for 3.5 weeks to buy a tube of toothpaste.
And laundry, as you can imagine, is an even worse problem.
Well, I think most of us would risk laundry troubles to go on some of those tours.
What have you lined up for future?
Well, next year looks like being a tremendous year. As you know, this is a reign of royal pelt. Her Majesty isn't just Queen of the United Kingdom, she's Queen of the whole Commonwealth. And already we know that in 1961, the Queen will be going to India, Pakistan, Persia, Italy, Ghana, Sierra Leone, Gambia.
You'd better get yourself a good supply of toothpaste.
Let's have another regular.
Well, of all the post-war musicals, including Oklahoma, my favorite is one that I think was the most rich in good numbers there ever was. It's called Kiss Me, Kate. I saw it 3 times in New York and 2 times in London. And more or less any song from it would feed me on my desert island. One splendid number is Why Can't You Behave? And here it is, sung by Lisa Kirk of the New York Times.
Why
Lisa Kirk singing Why Can't You Behave from the New York production of Kiss Me Kate, music and lyrics by Cole Porter. What next, sir?
Well, on my desert island, although there are some tunes I couldn't bear to hear again, a bit too poignant, as I said, I would want some chunks of nostalgia, so Pete's going to have one now, some straightforward, pumpy-sound piano playing. I used to love the regular beat of Charlie Coon.
Mm-hmm.
On this disc, he'd play a couple of tunes which take me back the second time to the war year. The era that was horrible, of course, but they had tunes which bring back some associations that weren't altogether unfit.
Charlie Coon playing Dearly Beloved and As Time Goes By. Now, about returning to the lighter side of your job, what's your favorite story?
Lighter side, this sounds like the most embarrassing moment department, is that it?
That's exactly it. Most embarrassing moment. What?
Wait.
One incident that still makes me prickle with embarrassment whenever I think of it. It was in the Outer Hebrides. I was covering a royal visit. Queen and the Duke were touring the island. I was by the side of the road recording a description of the people who were waiting for the royal party to arrive, and there were a number of very worthy but rather inconsiderate people who kept crowding round and rather pestering me and asking me questions in loud voices. I was getting rather fed up with them, and I asked politely if they'd leave me alone. And I was there adjusting my recording machine, and I heard footsteps stop immediately behind me. I didn't look up, but I said, rather crossly, outraged, "Do you mind moving away? I don't want to talk to anybody just now." Then I looked up, and I saw I'd been addressing the Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh.
Oh, damn, you're very good.
Now, Godfrey, how do you think you're going to be at looking after yourself on this desert island?
Oh, Lord. I don't know. I'm not a handy man at all. I was once a keen but rather incompetent boy scout.
Any hobbies might be...
Well, I'm not, alas, a fisherman. I can dig a garden. I have to. My wife has me dig it for her. Certain experiences in the war days made me able to dig a foxhole and a slip trench very quickly.
Yes.
So I might dig a shelter to live in, I suppose. I think I could fend for myself up to a point. For instance, I do know about the tropic sun and its usefulness and also the sun's danger.
Right. Well, I think we'll let you off any further interrogation and let's have another record.
Well, I'd like a comedian from one dating from before the war. A comedian, perhaps many people won't remember, because he had a very brief professional career. To my mind, he was one of the funniest men I ever saw. His name was John Gillies. We've just been talking about my undistinguished career as a Boy Scout, so let's have John Gillies, the Scoutmaster.
Buffaloes, 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 rally, 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 to me, ooh. Buffaloes, rally, boys, rally, ooh, to me. Extraordinary. No buffaloes. Excuse me, have you seen any buffaloes about here?
No, I'm a teetotaler.
Rally, boys, buffaloes, ooh, buffaloes, to me, rally. Late to death, I'm very sorry, but I'm afraid I've lost my scoop of trouts.
John Tilly as the Scoutmaster. And now we come to your last record, what's that going to be?
Well, this is one that is to be taken seriously. Very lovely record, very well known. Closing passage of Rachmaninoff's second piano concerto, played by Eileen Joyce. Glorious music played by a great artist. And I have a feeling, Roy, that I'd be playing this particular one long after I found that I couldn't bear the sound of the other seven.
finale of Rachmaninoff's second piano concerto with Eileen Joyce's soloist. Well, now, Godfrey, like every castaway, you're allowed to take one luxury to the desert island with you.
What?
Paper and something to write with and unlimited supplies. And what would you write?
Oh, I'd write everything and anything. Words, drawings, marks, diary, calendar, books, all sorts of things. Writing materials, I think, would save my sanity.
All right, and you're allowed one book, apart from the Bible and the works of Shakespeare and any book you write yourself.
What would you like?
Well, Macaulay's essay of the lot of them. It's fashionable to sneer at them, historically inaccurate and all that. But they do bear some relation to truth, but I love Macaulay's picturesque, great, rolling phrases. Old-fashioned, if you like, but I'm old-fashioned. Both my sons regard me, and they certainly will after this program, as the archetype of an early Victorian twirl.
Well, thank you, Godfrey Talbot, for letting you bear your choice of desert island here.
Thank you for indulging my very odd taste and for asking me to come.
Goodbye, everyone.
Goodbye.